Welcome to another Rational Face podcast episode, everybody. I am Brian Dillman.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Kissel.
Rational Face is a Mormon-based blog and podcast seeking to provide a safe, fair, and balanced space to discuss the complexities, difficulties, and beauty of our Mormon tradition.
Absolutely. In an entertaining and informal way, we are dedicated to exploring the vital, applicable, and expansive topics that we're all wrestling with as Mormons, while simultaneously keeping Mormonism weird.
Yeah, we normally keep Mormonism weird.
Try to.
But today, we're getting serious. So those of you who have been reading Rational Face posts over the last month or so, you know we have this project called this... We've adopted a Liahona Children's Foundation stake. And even if you've been reading, you still might be confused on what that is. And for those of you who haven't been and you're listening and hearing about this for the first time, we're going to explain it. We've got on the show today, we have an interview with Bob Reese, who is one of the founders of the Liahona Children's Foundation. So we want to get right to that. So the Liahona Children's Foundation is a humanitarian aid group that targets children that are in need that are age 5 and younger. And in the interview, Bob will explain why they've targeted that age range as a critical age to make sure that they have the nutrition that they need. So starving children in the developing or third world countries. And one of the ways they've organized this work is through quote-unquote stakes. Now, the stake that we have adopted to support is actually not a real stake like we know in the church. It's just an area that the foundation has selected to support the malnourished children in this area. And so every stake in the Liahona Children's Foundation actually means 100 malnourished children in this geographical area. So that's what the stake is. We're raising money for it. They've determined that $6,000 a year is enough to support 100 kids. And so that's our goal. And as of right now, we've raised $1,500, so we've got a ways to go. Listen to this interview. It's quite compelling, in my opinion, and shows how important and useful any small donation, or definitely large donations, it shows what good they really do.
Wonderful. So we want to get really quick into this interview because it's really interesting and provides a lot of different information. But we want to also inform you all that there's been lots of different questions of how to donate and maybe some of our different goals and exactly what we're trying to do. And we're going to go through all of that in the end section after the interview's played. So we'll go ahead and talk you through the whole donation process and how to do all of that specifically. So make sure you listen to the end.
And so with that kind of framing, let's jump right into the interview with Bob. All right, everybody. I have a great guest on the show today, Robert Reese, who is one of the founders of the Liahona Children Foundation. And he's here to tell us how the foundation got started and how it works and some of his experiences in doing humanitarian aid in the church and otherwise. So, Robert Reese, please say hello and tell us just briefly about yourself and what has pointed you towards wanting to be involved in humanitarian work.
Great. Well, it's a pleasure to be talking with you about this. I've been a Latter-day Saint since I joined the church when I was a young boy, and I'm actually a fifth-generation Latter-day Saint, but my family has been converted independently in 4 different generations, so it's kind of an interesting story. I'm a child of the Depression. I was born in 1935 in the middle of the Depression, and we were very poor. I know what it's like to not have enough food and to have a dirt floor and to not have indoor plumbing and all of that. But out of that experience of the Depression, I think I also learned the importance of self-reliance and the importance of cooperation. You know, my parents were poor, but they always had room at the table for one more, whether they were strangers or neighbors or whatever. And they were hardworking people with good virtues, and those have been a blessing to me in addition to what I've learned as a member of the church. And so I think my impulse toward humanitarian work comes out of that personal background, but it also comes out of my my commitment to Christ and to his gospel, which it seems to me is essentially Christ was essentially a savior to the poor and the needy, and of course to everyone, but the focus of his ministry was clearly on the disadvantaged and the downtrodden. And so when one reads the scriptures, it's hard to escape the reality of that message, especially as it is articulated in the 25th chapter of Matthew, which in a sense makes all of us are condemned before that that scripture, because none of us is as obedient, or let's say as diligent in administering to the needs of the least among us as Christ calls us to. So, but I think the important thing is to have the impulse to do that. So, my wife and I served nearly 4 years humanitarian service as humanitarian service representatives of the church in the Baltic states from 1992 to 96, right as the Soviet Union collapsed. And so the conditions there were really third world conditions, or conditions, sometimes that's called the developing world, but there was a lot of poverty and a lot of unemployment. And so we had an opportunity. When we went to Lithuania, there were no members of the church in the entire country except for us. And so we had an opportunity to both share the gospel, but also to be of service to others there. And so one of the things we did is we set up a foundation called Shema, which in Lithuanian means family. It was a private nonprofit foundation which could then work with desert industries to bring goods from the church to bless the people of the Baltics. And that was a terrific experience. I'm also very involved in Mormon scholarship and teaching. I teach Mormonism at Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, and also at the University of California at Berkeley, and was on the original committee to set up the Mormon Studies program at Claremont University. So I'm very involved in writing and thinking about things relating to Mormonism, including doing a lot of work right now on what's called the Mormon faith crisis. So that's at least a few things about me.
Oh, great. That's a lot of experience. And it seems both your, I guess, early life experience as well as your religious faith point you in this direction of humanitarian work. Is that right?
Very much so. I find the I worked, one of the things that I did in Lithuania was to work with desert industries to bring carloads of or container loads of medical equipment and clothing and other things to the people there. And I'm also, for the past 15, 20 years, I've been involved in interfaith work. I'm on the board of the Marin Interfaith Council here in Northern California, and we do a lot of work for and addressing the needs of the homeless. We have a street ministry. We do a number of things in which different religions join together to deal with issues of social justice and poverty and employment and things of this nature.
So I'd like to talk, I guess, briefly, similar to your experience in doing humanitarian work in the Baltic states. I serve my mission in Cambodia, and I remembered coming home, serving there, and seeing all that I saw coming home, and I sat on the lawn or on a bench at Weber State University, and I was looking at the grass and the concrete, and the buildings that Weber State at that time wasn't actually a very spectacular looking university, but compared to where I had been, it looked quite spectacular. And I thought of all the jobs that just maintaining the lawn itself mm-hmm. would provide, and the construction of the buildings. And I was just blown away at how much we have, just sitting on a bench, being fresh home from my mission. And since that time, my heart's been pricked periodically to try and do something. And being involved with Rational Face, we've adopted a stake that is located in Cambodia. And so I finally got to the point where I feel like I'm starting to do something and, you know, rid my conscience a little bit of that guilt. So I'm really appreciative of the Liahona Foundation, because a lot of times I feel like we don't know where to start. We feel like we mm-hmm. want to help somebody, but we don't know where to start besides maybe handing, cash or bread or something to people on the streets. And the Liahona Children's Foundation, among others, seems to provide the way of the means for us to help others, especially those beyond our eyesight or beyond what we interact in every day. So tell us a little bit about the Liahona Children's Foundation and how it started.
Great. That's a good way to talk about this. And, Dr. Brad Walker, who is the co-founder with me, was in, in Cusco in Central America. He went to a hospital to talk to one of the pediatricians there who was a stake president, and he saw this extremely emaciated, acutely malnourished child. And he just was alarmed at, we've all seen those pictures of children who are too completely stunted and wasted and, you know, look like they're just a step away from death, and many of them are. And he was shocked by that. And and the child, in fact, did not survive. It was a Latter-day Saint child. And he came home thinking, if there's any child in the world that is like that, we ought to try and do something about it. So he wrote a couple of articles for Dialogue called Moving Zion Southward. It was really, I think, a clarion call to Latter-day Saints to get outside of the rather narrow scope of our own lives and to begin looking at the condition of our Latter-day Saint brothers and sisters in the developing world. And the church or the foundation started its work in, we were doing different things, but in 2008, a group of BYU students and some people from the foundation went to Ecuador and Guatemala and screened over 2,000 children there. And let me just stop for a minute to say, when I talk about screening, the World Health Organization says any place in the world, first 5 years of life, you can tell whether a child is malnourished by taking their age, their height, and their weight. Combining those three data points gives you a figure that you then can very clearly say, determine immediately whether this child is malnourished or severely malnourished, or whether the child is in good health. So we went into those two countries and evaluated the kids in the stakes. We found that 41% were stunted, 24% were underweight, 10% were wasted. In other words, their weight is very much below what it should be. And then what we did and what we've continued to do is to set up a program whereby at the end of a screening session, maybe it's 2 or 3 hours, or maybe it's an all day if we're doing kids in a stake, we know we have the names of all of the kids who are malnourished. And we focus on the ages 6 months to 5 years, because that is the critical period for body and especially brain development. And so since we have limited funds, we can't address the malnutrition of every child, but we do focus on those critical first 4.5 to 5 years. And then so we have the names of those children. We ask the state or district president for the name of a trustworthy and capable woman we can engage to be a local coordinator. We pay her a very modest fee. We then make it possible for her to get supplements, which we identify in each country. We don't ship supplements because the shipping costs are prohibitive, but we find a really good source of nutritional supplements within the country. We have pediatricians on our staff who and nutritionalists who can you know evaluate nutritional information or nutrition material we provide for the children. So the coordinator gets that those nutritional supplements. She gets them to each of the families who have a malnourished child or children on a monthly basis. And we also then provide micronutrient supplements where necessary. We also do deworming. We try to educate the family about the importance of nutrition and how they can use whatever resources they have to make sure their children are getting as much nutrition as is possible, given the limited resources in their country. We have in the past tried to respond to the needs of children who are of elementary school age but who are not able to go to school. And then we provide an annual Christmas party for the kids just to give them at least one experience in the year in which they are getting something rather than nothing. So that's kind of the program that we set up. One of the remarkable things about the work we do is that we can provide all the nutritional supplements that a child needs for an entire year for $60. And that's just an amazing thing to think that that for $60 you can take care of the needs of a malnourished child for an entire year. So that program began in Central America, and then slowly and I had a foundation when I read Dr. Walker's articles in Dialogue. I immediately got in touch with him and said, I want to be a part of what you're doing. And I had a foundation which had kind of been dormant while I was in the Baltic states. And so I said, why don't we kind of retool this foundation to find a new name for it and refocus it I was involved in arts and humanities work with that foundation, but we reshaped it to address children's malnutrition. And so that's when we set up in 2008, we set up the Liahona Children's Nutrition Education Foundation, and it's a federally recognized nonprofit 501c3, so all donations are tax deductible, and so that helps because you want people who donate to be able to get the tax benefit from doing so. So having started in those countries, we then began to move to other countries and to again focus on these early years. One of the things that really helped me understand the importance of this work was to look at the long-term effects of malnutrition. If you would look at the brain of a child who is malnourished as opposed to one who is properly nourished, the child's brain is about half the size of a child who gets the proper nutrition. And the 80% of the child's brain develops by age 3, 90% of it develops by the age of 5. So, and it's not reversible. So in other words, if a child is not getting the nutrition it needs during those critical first 3 to 5 years, that child's brain will be damaged for his or her entire life. So that certainly for me was important to understand that and to begin to look at the long-term effects of malnutrition, which not only are poor growth and stunting, but delayed mental and motor development, poor school performance, reduced intellectual achievement, increased susceptibility to disease and illness, and decreased work capacity, and certainly reduced economic productivity. So you think about this. If you could take a child from age 6 months to 5 years for $60 a year, let's say at the most you have spent $300 to take the child through those critical years, a child whose malnutrition is addressed is much more likely to go to school, elementary school, to go on to secondary school or get secondary training, much more likely to go on a mission, much more likely to find good employment, to be a to make a good marriage decision, to be a Relief Society president or bishop or other leaders, and then in the course of their lifetime to pay back in tithes and fast offerings many, many times the $300 that was invested in them. On the other hand, if you don't spend that $300, that child and that child's brain and body does not develop, then it's much more likely that child will not go to school or not be successful in school, will not likely be employable or not very highly employable, will then not not have the intellectual or physical capacity to be a functional or really productive, let's say a productive adult, and therefore would be a dependent upon his or her family or the church or community or government for the rest of their lives. So if you look at something that we might call the return of an investment, it's just an enormous return for such a small amount of money.
I think that's a key thing to point out, that this is like a switch on the railroad track for the rest of their lives, for opportunity or being bereft of opportunity for the rest of their lives. So this has a huge impact, and really it's the thing that kind of blows my mind is the $60 a year is sufficient to flip that switch. And is that pretty universal throughout the developing world, or does it fluctuate a little bit?
It fluctuates some, but that's a figure that we have a lot of confidence in because we've been doing this for a long time, so we know what it costs. And supplements are a little higher in some countries than another, sometimes a little harder to find. But if we get $60, we can take care of a child for that amount. And so, beginning with that, those first couple of countries, we now are operating in Africa, in Zimbabwe and Mozambique, in South Africa, in Central America and South America, in the Philippines, in Cambodia, as you mentioned, in Mongolia, we hope soon to be going into Mexico and Haiti. And in between Christmas and New Year's, I'm flying to an island nation in the South Pacific called Kiribati. It's spelled Kiribati, K-I-R-I-B-A-T-I, but it's pronounced Kiribati, because that island nation has 17% of its population is Latter-day Saint, and they have a high degree of malnutrition. So the area presidency in the South Pacific, with whom I met with the area welfare director in Auckland in May, and to talk about where we could do a pilot program, and so they want us to go there. So four of us are going to Kiribati and in between Christmas and New Year's to do screening.
How much has it grown since 2008?
Well, when we went into I'm trying to remember how many states we did in those countries. There were 9 stakes, actually, in Ecuador and Guatemala in 2008-2009. We're now in over 120 stakes worldwide.
Oh, wow. That's really good, because it indicates that there's been a lot of malnourishment that has been addressed, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, so we're still meeting just a fraction of the needs or the malnourished children in the church. Your listeners would be interested to know that for every Latter-day Saint child, we try to screen a non Latter-day Saint child. That is, we want this to be not simply Latter-day Saints, but we're also limited in our resources. So we try to do a one-for-one screening. But we're trying, and we have we've increased the funding has increased about tenfold in 4 years. Our donations just come from individual Latter-day Saints who learn about our work and want to be a part of it. And so we're hoping to continue to grow. And I think as more people know about this work, it's really, from my point of view, it's really joyful work. I've been to Guatemala and to the Philippines and to Colombia just this summer, screening children. And it's just an amazing experience to see these sweet, dear little children who are, you know, God's children, but who do not have basic means of survival. And some of them, in fact, have died, and some, in fact, are dying. And so the need is critical. And the parents, I must say that the parents are so immensely grateful, as you could, as anybody with children might imagine, someone who can help their child. So we're blessed. We have a lot of volunteers. We have terrific people in these developing countries as serving as our coordinators, and other people who volunteer to help us. But it's all volunteer work, and just amazing to see people giving of their time and money. We have interns from BYU and Utah State and Utah Valley University who, working with their professors, come down and help us, and they get credit for participating in this work.
Well, it's really good to see it's growing, and there's a lot of interest in it. One of the questions I've received, as we've put some blogs out there to publicize our support for it, is, why is it that this problem exists? Because obviously world hunger is a huge, huge issue, and there's a lot of things contributing to it. But ideally, the fast offerings, either locally or the surplus from Western Europe and the United States, should be directed to these developing countries. But as you've seen, there's still a great need for organizations like the Liahona Children's Foundation. So could you comment on that at all? Why is it that the traditional fast offering method is not sufficient?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's one that we encounter frequently. There is a difference between the way the church functions in the developing world, the developed world, and the way it functions in the developing world. For example, I've been a bishop, and so I know that I take in fast offering funds, which then I can use to help the needy people in my ward. And if I run out of those, I can appeal to the stake president for additional funds, and that works in that way in the developed world. But a bishop or a stake or a branch president in Guatemala or Cambodia or the Philippines can't hope to take in enough in fast offering funds to meet the needs of, let's say you have a ward in which 20, 30, 40% of the children are malnourished. That bishop or branch president simply does, nor does the stake president. So the church has set up a different system. So each area of the church has a welfare director, and that welfare director's responsibility is to meet a lot of the needs of people. So it's a different system. The other thing is that a lot of leaders in the developing world don't really know about the way the church functions to address its neediest members. So when everyone either is malnourished or looks malnourished, not everybody, you can't always, malnourishment is in many ways a pretty invisible condition, because you can look at a child, looks like a healthy 3-year-old, and they may in fact be a malnourished 5-year-old. And people also are used to generations of malnourishment. So, for example, I sometimes talk to people about work we're doing in Guatemala, and they say, well, I look at those children, and Guatemalans are just naturally short. Well, Guatemalans are naturally short because of generations of stunting. If you look at some doctor friends of mine in Utah County, said you can tell the difference, because if you look at the children of the immigrants from these countries, the children are a foot higher than their parents, taller than their parents. So part of it, I think, is inexperience. Part of it is that in the developing world, the church works through area offices rather than through in the system that we have in North America. Although it's supposed to, they're supposed to be somewhat parallel. The church, I think, is now you know, we've had that. With the our foundation representatives, we've met with the head of welfare and the head of humanitarian service in Salt Lake City. We've had, I think, three meetings with them, and they have been helpful in trying to connect us with the area welfare directors to get them to help provide some of the resources. And for example, when I go to Kiribati in at the end of this month, then I think the area welfare office will be interested in working with us to see if together we can combine resources to meet the needs of these children. The other thing, that it's kind of a cultural thing, and it's something that we wouldn't normally think of, but since I've been involved in this work for a long time, I've encountered it a lot, that because we have such a strong emphasis in the church on self-reliance, there is a reluctance for people to give something without somebody either earning it or working for it. And so I talk to people, and they say, well, you know, we're worried about these kids becoming dependent. Well, the fact of the matter is that the kids, by God's design, are dependent. You can't talk to a 3-year-old or 5-year-old about self-reliance, because they have no, they're not like baby wildebeests or wolves or whatever. They are human babies incapable of taking care of themselves. And so I think part of it is overcoming that, what I think is a cultural bias against giving. And again, part of this comes naturally out of our perspective of living in North America or Europe, where where governments very often take care of the neediest, and there are people who feel that, you know, the welfare mother or the person living on the dole, and that just encourages indolence, et cetera, et cetera. And while it's true that that happens in some cases, most of the people that I've known are people who are eager to work, who don't want to be dependent, who want to be independent. And so I think it's part of it is kind of changing the culture in the developed world, and helping people to see the need. I was fortunate enough to be invited a week ago to attend a training in Salt Lake City, sponsored by the church's Perpetual Education Fund, which is now in the process of retooling to become what I think eventually will be called the self-reliance program. The church now has set up over 1,000 self-reliance centers in stakes in the developing world. Eventually this will be in every stake in the church, but right now the church is focusing on that, and it's really a wonderful model in which they're setting up these self-reliance centers in each stake. And I've run into them when I've been screening children for the foundation. And what they do is they have a kind of a three-prong approach, which is it's education, employment, and then they also teach entrepreneurship. So they're really trying to help people lift themselves out of poverty, and it's an inspired model. This is a committee, self-reliance or perpetual education fund self-reliance, that is a committee that reports directly to the first presidency. And so a week ago they invited direction of the first presidency, they invited 20 Mormon NGOs to come in and spend 2 days with them so we could learn about what they're doing and they could learn about what we're doing. And they were very interested in our work and very interested in saying, wow, we need to find ways of feeding these children and taking care of the malnourished children. So I think part of it is education. A part of it is awareness. Part of it is changing a culture. But for a church that prides itself on taking care of its own, ultimately, this is one of the fundamental ways in which that commitment and that covenant to take care of the neediest can be met. My own sense is that, you know, almost every program in the church, including the welfare program and the perpetual education program, started outside the church in a stake or in a ward or with a group someplace, and then the church adopted it. So it's our hope that eventually the church will adopt this idea of taking ownership of all of the malnourished children. And I think there's a much greater openness to this, because I think there's a much greater awareness because of what the work the foundation has done. So I'm very hopeful that we're in a period of transition to a new model in which perhaps we and maybe the church itself will identify these malnourished children, and then through church avenues and resources, those needs will be met. But also, we're working on a model that you know about called Adopt a Stake, where we are trying to get stakes in the developing world to adopt stakes, or in the developed world to adopt stakes in the developing world. And so, I, in fact, this very day, I presented the Fifth Sunday Relief Society priesthood lesson, and it was on the San Rafael stake where I live, adopting a stake. Our stake president has been very generous in allowing us to set up an adopt a stake program in Marin County in Northern California, and we are in the process of raising the funds to adopt the stake, and people here are very eager to support that. And part of you said something I think earlier about people wanting to do something. The great thing about what we do is that you can do a little bit and it can make a huge difference. One of the members, our CEO, Alan Jones, who lives in Salt Lake, had the idea. He said, well, why don't we take quart jars and give them to everybody in our ward who wants them, and if they just put in $1 a day into that quart jar, in a year they will have put in enough money to take care of 6 children in the developing world for an entire year. So you just imagine that you do that. So today I ask people in my ward who wants a bottle or a jar with a Liahona sticker on it. I'll get it and give it to you next Sunday, and you can start putting your loose change and your extra dollar or dollar two as you come home from work or school or wherever you are, and you empty your pockets at night, empty them into the jar. And if you just do $1 a day, that will be $360 that you can contribute to helping needy children. So, but again, it's just, when I taught a course at the University of California, Santa Cruz, a few years ago, and it was called Developing a Global Consciousness, and it was about the interface between the developed world and the developing world. And we were reading a lot of material coming out of Vietnam and Guatemala and Africa, really wonderful literature that the students were exposed to. And the whole purpose of that course was to teach them to understand that, and I would sometimes teach the entire freshman introductory day at Merrill College, and I would say, let's reduce the world to 100 people. In that 100 of those 100 people, how many of them own a computer? And I would say just one. How many of them can sleep in the kind of bed you sleep in each night? Probably one. How many of them have a car? Less than one. And I was trying to get the students to understand that even though they feel poor, and even though they feel they don't have enough, they really represent 1% of the people of the world. And that's true of almost every Latter-day Saint in North America, that we all feel we don't have enough money or enough resources, but we really are the 1% in relation to the entire world. And so anyone can give up, if you just give up eating a meal out a month, or if you just give up, you know, buying an extra pair of jeans or something that you may not really need, and just put it in a jar, you can. I think almost everybody could find a dollar a day with sometimes no sacrifice or sometimes with just a little bit of sacrifice.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it into very, understandable terms or very achievable terms. So it doesn't feel like this insurmountable task. And you've also, you've talked about ways that people can donate. They can donate, they can adopt a stake as a group or I suppose as an individual if they had the means. They can, my father actually said, like I think you said, it's $60 per year.
Mm-hmm.
To support a child, and my father told me that he put in enough to support two for the next year, and so it makes it very achievable the way that you've described it, but it also makes it a little bit more tangible because you can say I've put this much forward, and I know that it's helped one child is better off because of that.
Yeah, it's you make a good point, and the we have people who you can go on our website, which is LeahonaChildren.org, and you can there through either PayPal or by sending a check to an address in Utah, you can write a check, and we have people who write. I have a widow who lives in my state, who after the end of at meeting her basic needs, she has. Maybe around $40 or $50. She sends me a check for $10 or more every month. Now here's a woman who lives very much on the margin. And one thing that's interesting to me is that I often, when people say, well, why isn't the church doing more? Or why isn't the church doing this? And my response is, when I read the 25th chapter of Matthew, I am aware that when I face the Lord will not say to me, what did your church do? It'll say to me, "What, Bob, what did you do? Did you yourself as an individual consider these the least and give them food or drink or clothing or shelter or whatever?" So that to me, and you know, I'm kind of one of one of the things that I often say to people is what Mother Teresa said. She said, we can do no great things, only small things with great love. So even if it's small, even if, you know, there was a time when children in the church contributed to the primary children's hospital, they brought their pennies or their dimes each Sunday. So just a little bit can go a very, very long way.
Yeah. And I like how you say that we often, in the Bloggernacle and on podcasts, we criticize the church and we talk about different aspects that we either find interesting or that we want to tear apart. And one of those things is the way the church spends money or appears to spend money anyway. And it's frustrating to not see it, not be able to see it spent the way we think that it should be. And, you know, we wonder, why don't they see this great need? Why don't they act on this great need? But because of organizations like the Liahona Children's Foundations, we can. We don't need to wait for the church to get in line with our understanding of the way we need to help others. We can do it right now. And so that's...
Yeah, and I think the other thing, I think in fairness, it's really important to know what a great thing the church does with its resources. I contribute to different organizations, and I have always had confidence that my money was... the church was a good steward of my money. And when I was in Lithuania and the Baltic states doing humanitarian service work, I could see the generosity of the saints and also the terrific resources of the church, which were being through humanitarian service and other things. So, you know, I don't know, for example, I know that people tend to be critical of City Creek and other things, but it well could be that the church built the City Creek in order to generate funds to help with building temples and taking care of people. We don't know because we don't have a transparent financial accounting. But I feel that the church, I see the church in many ways as being extremely generous and of blessing people in lots of ways. Some of the people who are critical of the church go to church every Sunday in buildings paid by tithing money by other people, and they read manuals that are paid by somebody, and they have heat and other resources that are paid. So I think that it's easy in some ways to criticize the church, but we also I know what I can do, and my stewardship is for what I can do. That's what I'm accountable for, and so that's what I try to encourage people to do, is to take care of what they can do, and this is something that was in the purview of anybody to do something for.
Yeah, I agree with everything that you've said there, Bob. So I think that's a really good overview and understanding of the need, and as well the way the Liahona Children's Foundation works. Well, one quick question on that. So who actually delivers the goods, the nutritional supplements?
Okay, is that the
coordinator?
Yeah, so what we do, it's a very simple program, but it's very effective. When we identify a woman that, you know, by reputation is a responsible, honest person, and we choose her to be our area, our state coordinator, and we have area coordinators, country coordinators as well. We then set up a bank account with her. We then transfer funds into that account. We help her find the source of the nutritional supplements. And then each month she gets those. We like to do it on a month-to-month basis, because if people have more than that, they might be tempted to sell it or to use more than they should for that period of time. So it's a way of kind of managing and accounting for this. So each month she gets the supplements and she takes them to the families and gives them to them. And then that's really the way the system works. And then we do rescreenings in every 6 months. So you can, if a child's getting a nutrition, you can tell right away that child is being blessed. And I mean, one of the things that's kind of heartbreaking, you talking about Cambodia, you know, as we look at the kind of critical needs of Latter-day Saint children, it differs from country to country. Although what's really interesting is that our screenings often show that the malnutrition among Latter-day Saint children very often parallels that identified of the world, of the country population identified by the World Health Organization. But then what we sometimes find is that and for example, when we first went into Cambodia a couple of years ago, we found that 76% of the children were malnourished. In the Philippines, it's about 50%. And one of the things that was very touching to me, and you asked for earlier when we were talking before I came on for a story, when I was in Guatemala, up in the mountains of Chulak, northern Guatemala, we were screening a district up there. There were four branches. And these people were very poor. Many of them walk an hour or more to church. And yet they are extremely faithful. So we screened them and found that about 50% of the kids were malnourished. So I interviewed the district president, and I asked him a couple of questions. But one of them, I said, well, I'm just curious, what percentage of the people in your district pay tithing? And he said 50%. So I thought, oh my gosh, that's amazing that these people, without very much resources, are very faithful in keeping their covenants, and are also very generous in trying to help other people. And sitting on his lap was his daughter, who had just had an operation on her feet that were turned inward. And so I asked if there's anything I do, and he said, well, we can't afford shoes for our daughter, and if she doesn't get the shoes, then the operation won't be very effective. So when I came home and went home teaching I told one of the families I home teach about this, and they said, "Oh, we'll buy the shoes for them," and so they did, and it's just it's a very gratifying thing to see that just doing a little bit can help a great deal, and that that you can see an immediate payoff. Both in terms of just looking into the faces of these grateful parents, but also just handling the children. Occasionally, I will pick up a child and I'll know immediately this child is severely malnourished. And so I will call the mother and the bishop or the district leader aside and say, you know, here, this child needs immediate attention. Here's some resources to get them immediate help. So there, some of these kids are in critical condition, and it's heartbreaking for the parents because they often know because they're feeding the children or not feeding them.
Are you familiar with the book The Rent Collector? It's kind of popular a year ago.
No, I don't know that book. I know another book called The Life You Can Save by Peter Singer, which is a terrific book to read. But anyway, tell me about The Rent Collector.
Yeah, it's a fictional story based on real people, real characters.
Mm-hmm.
This man in Salt Lake had a son that went on a mission to Cambodia, and he did a documentary that ended up winning some awards about this family that lives in a garbage dump. And so he just wrote this story on it. And that was really one of the things. I got that for Christmas last year from my mother-in-law. And it's published by Deseret Book, and I generally don't read a lot from Deseret Book. But it just really struck me because he did a good job.
Good.
Really describing the situations that people are living in. That would be appalling to us living here in the West. So that's one thing I think people could pick up if they wanted to get a better idea of what other people in the world are experiencing.
Yeah, and Peter Singer is basically saying you can save the life of at least one child someplace in the world. It's really a good book. He's a professor of ethics, I believe, at Princeton. You know, one of the things I was thinking about when we were talking before about just the stories the when you encounter these people. When I was in Guatemala, two of the coordinators down there have actually lost children to malnutrition, and they're just I can't tell you how sweet and dedicated these women are. And when I was in Guatemala, one of the coordinators or one of the student interns said, you know, these coordinators are taking the money you give them to coordinate, and they're spending it on the children. And I said, oh, my gosh, I didn't know that. So I called one of them apart, just dear, dear sister, and I said, Gloria, I said, I want you to understand that the small amount of money we pay you to be a coordinator is for you and your family, and we don't expect you to be spending this on the children. We're trying to do that. And she said, no, she says, we consider this holy work. And I was very touched by that here's a woman with practically nothing who is taking the little bit of the small stipend that we pay her, which amounts to about $40 a month, to do the coordinating. She was taking that money and spending it on the poor. it's interesting that in Kings, I think is the prophet is it Ezekiel? I think it's Ezekiel who's during a time of famine, and God sends him to the home of a widow to be fed, and the widow has just enough meal and oil to make one cake, which she and her son can eat. So she says, "So we will eat this cake and we will die." And it's so interesting to me that here this person with one meal between her and death shares what she has with the prophet, and then of course is blessed, as I think all of us are blessed who give of our means to bless others.
Yeah, I I remember that story. I think that was Elisha or Elijah.
Yeah. You're right. I thank you for the clarification on that.
I remember Ezekiel this morning in Sunday school.
Immediately gravitated there. Ezekiel gets stuck in your head.
Right.
But yeah, I was struck when I read that on my mission. I remember thinking, I know people that are in this position that literally go out to find sticks so they can cook the little bit that they have, a little bit of rice. Yeah. And, that's not a fictionalized story in the Bible that is so far removed from everyday experience for so many people today. Maybe you could share other ways that people could be involved if they feel so inclined.
Great. That's a good segue. We have, NutriTours, so that people can actually, families or individuals can go with us and help with the screening. And at the same time that they're doing that, they can take some time to see the ruins or to visit nature parks or do other things. And so those NutriTours, which generally last from a week to 2 weeks, depending on what people wonder. We have one going, I think, to Peru and maybe Ecuador over Christmas. And so people can find that. If they go to our website, we've got a section called Getting Involved, where they can read about internships and NutriTours and volunteering. They can read about the Adopt-A-Steak program. They can read about the science of our malnutrition and something about us. So I think the main thing from my point of view is, I was very struck by what Elder Holland said. He said, I don't know, I can't tell you what you should do. At the end of his talk, when he was this terrific talk at October conference, I think it's the best talk he's given of during his apostleship, frankly. And he said, I don't know, I can't tell you what you should do. I don't know what you should do, he said, but the Lord knows. And I think for each of us, we can make that a matter of prayer. We can make it a matter of thought and matter of talking to our families. What can we do? Can we help a child, a single child, someplace in the developing world this year? Let's do that as a family project, or let's find other ways of helping. So we do every year, we try to do a hunger banquet in Utah. In that hunger banquet, people come in and they get one of three different colored tickets. And that ticket lets them know whether they're going to be served a three or four course meal at a table with tablecloths and china, or if they're going to be served a meal of a bowl of beans and rice sitting at a table, or whether they're going to sit on the floor on a carpet and have a bowl of rice. And then we tell them that this is the bowl of rice is what many people, our brothers and sisters, that's all they have. And when I went before I went to Lithuania, I went to a training at the church humanitarian service office in Salt Lake, and they asked a question that I'd never considered before, which is, how do you teach the law of the fast to people who never eat more than one meal a day? Or as I said last Sunday, or last Fast Sunday in my Sunday school class, I said, what if every day of your life felt like this? Because most of us get pretty cranky on Fast Sunday. I said, what if every day of your life was a Fast Sunday? It's pretty sobering, and especially when you think about these dear children.
Yeah, it is. It's very sobering to think about the reality of the lived experience in the developing world. Well, Bob, thank you so much for coming on the show and teaching us more about the Liahona Children's Foundation. And to all the listeners, if you haven't yet, go and read liahonachildren.org, and we'll have links in the show notes. and all that, but just become aware of it. Talk with your stake leaders, adopt a stake, talk with your family members. Maybe your extended family can get together and adopt a stake or adopt a certain number of children. This is a great organization that facilitates our aid, that helps us to give in a way that's very, very meaningful. So thanks again for coming on, Bob.
You bet. My great pleasure. And thank all of you who listen to this. If you can do something for the children in the developing world.
Wow. Okay. So that was such a wonderful interview. Thank you so much, Bob Reese, for coming on to the podcast to kind of help us explore some of these differing topics. I think a lot of my different questions were answered in that. I love when I was listening to that, I thought it was so compelling. And it's such a strange thing. Like for me, the very first time I heard about the Liahona Children's Foundation, it's kind of this like really strange thing. And as I've tried to explain the foundation to other people, it's hard to really recognize that this is occurring. You know, as I'm sitting here in my house with the heater and way too much food and all of these different things, just all the benefits that we have, it is crazy to even imagine that there are people starving to death and children starving and being malnourished, and in particular LDS members who are going through this, because you would think that fast offerings and some of these other things would be able to cover that. But the more that I'm learning about this foundation, I just think it's such a wonderful and important cause for us to be looking more into. So I'm so happy that Rational Faiths is taking this seriously and attempting to raise this money.
Yeah, I think they get right to a need that is so universal. It's a need whether you're Mormon or not, but it's just something that needs to happen, and they've taken up the reins and they've directed these efforts and built this foundation so that it makes it really easy for us to actually do some good with the surplus income that we have, or income that we generate by sacrificing some lunches or whatever it might be.
Absolutely. One of the things that you guys were talking about that I felt was really powerful is I'm very involved in like online Mormonism, you know, and having lots of different conversations about the church and about different historical and social issues. And it feels like I'm often criticizing differing aspects of what we happen to be doing. And when I come across something like this, it's like that message that Bob was saying, that we are the church, you know, like, what am I really doing to make the world a better place? You know, what, like recognizing some of these terrible things that are occurring in the world where for example, children are not able to, like, you have these serious problems where they're not able to have enough nutrition to be able to develop properly. And it's like, we can kind of help with that. We don't have to go, oh, well, the church should be doing all these things, because we are the church, you know. And to me, it's like, man, I need to do more. I this is something that I can help.
Yeah, and I think Rational Faith adopting this stake, this provides an opportunity for all of our readers and all of our listeners to, you know, take let's say they get $20 from their grandma for Christmas, or they get an Amazon gift certificate. Yeah. They could sell that to a friend or something. Now they've got cash that is on their hands, and they can donate that right away. That's the easy. I mean, and then that is $20 would take care of one child for a third of a year, for instance. So let's talk about that. There's a couple ways that you can donate, and obviously we're adopting a stake. Some of the ways you can think about it are $60. If you can make a $60 donation, either a lump sum, or you can set up a recurring donation so that over the course of a year, if you donate $5 a month, Over the course of a year, you have donated $60 and you have saved a life. You have saved a child's life. That's enough money that will save a child's life. Yep, so you can do a recurring donation, you can do a lump sum, and you can write a check on our main blog post about this, where if you click on the Liahona Children's Foundation banner on the Rational Face main page, it'll take you right to that post. They've got links and directions, and they've got an address. You can mail a check to the foundation, or you can pay through PayPal, or you can pay through a credit card. And so one thing is that in order to have it contribute to our group, the Rational Face Stake, and we actually have the Cultural Hall podcast is going to advertise this as well. They want to partner with us in this effort. What you need to do is you need to write on the check in the comment section, DAKHMAU, TA KHMAU. And you need to write that in a comment section on the PayPal form. And sometimes that's kind of hard to see. And so I think we should walk through a donation right now.
Yeah, that's what I was wanting to do. So let's say I'm wanting to donate. So where's the first place that I need to go?
Okay, go to rationalfaith.com.
Okay, I am at rationalfaith.com.
Okay, now scroll down and you'll see, you'll get past the main featured posts. And on the right-hand side, there's a bunch of banners, and the top banner is the Liahona Children's Foundation. Click on that.
Okay, so I'm scrolling down the side, and I see the link for Liahona Foundation. So I'm clicking on that. Okay, so I'm at this post, and it says, join with us in supporting DAKHMAU. DAKHMAU.
DAKHMAU.
DAKHMAU. DAKHMAU. Okay.
You got to... Yeah,
thank you.
We'll work on your Cambodian pronunciation later. But if you scroll down to the middle, there's a address there. That's where you could mail a check. And just above that, there's a link for online donation. And that'll take you right to the Liahona Children Foundation page where you can donate. But before we go there, click on the picture that's right in the middle of the post that has like some red arrows on it. And expand that out so you can see it. So when you pay via PayPal, you'll have a couple choices. Like you'll be able to choose how much money you want to donate, whether you want to do a recurring donation. And then it'll automatically, once you sign into your PayPal account, it'll come to this next page. And there's that little link-looking thing that says add special instructions to the seller. You have to click on that, and it'll open up a comment box, and you type in DAKHMAU in that comment box.
Okay, so you're not even going to see that box unless you click on that little button. Okay.
Right, yeah, the box isn't open unless you click on it. So you got to click on that little link, and that'll open it up, type in DAKHMAU, and then you can make the payment, and it'll be recorded, and we'll be able to keep track of our donations. And if you scroll to the bottom of the post, we've got a really sweet graphic of a thermometer with our donations. And so as the donations go up, that thermometer will keep going up, and we're really hoping to hit $6,000 by the end of the year. Anyway, let's go back to the online donation link. So click on that link, Brian. We'll take you to the PayPal donation.
Okay, so I pulled up that screen. It says donate today to nourish a child, and then it showed me some options: one-time donation, or I can go to recurring.
Yeah, so one-time or recurring. Under the one-time, they have suggestions of 10, 25, 50, 100, 200, 500, or other. If you want to do $60 to feed one child a year, well, they're saying 50 here. Do 60 anyway. Just do a little
exactly
bit
that,
more.
That's the full amount. Yeah. So, and we kind of calculated it. If we get what do we need? About like
75.
Yeah, about 75 more people. Donating about 60. But if you can't do 60, then do any amount that you can do.
Yeah, any amount that you can give will be put to good use. Okay, so if you do the one-time donation, the lump sum, when you go through the PayPal or credit card page, you'll see the picture that's on the website, and it'll have this little link, add special instructions to the seller. You click on that link, and then you can type in DAKHMAU there, and it'll get earmarked for our group. If you go to a recurring donation, it doesn't have that option for some reason. Kamau, what you need to do is send an email. Once you have the donation submitted, send an email to ShaylaAvery@LeahonaChildren.org. That email address is going to be in the show notes or the blog post associated with this podcast episode. So email ShaylaAvery@LeahonaChildren.org, and she'll be able to, and tell her, you know, the pertinent information. You set up, you know, $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever it is, your name, all that stuff, and she'll be able to make sure that gets put into the Dak Kamau fund to support the children in Dak Kamau with the Rational Faiths.
Wonderful.
All right. I hope that clarifies how to donate to the Liahona Children's Foundation with Rational Faiths. So if things still aren't clear, leave some comments for us. We'll help clear things up. Encourage your friends, your neighbors, as you're meeting with family for the Christmas holidays. Encourage them, instead of giving you a gift, you know, donate in your name or something to the Liahona Children's Foundation. It's an excellent cause, an excellent group to support.
Yeah, and one more thing that I'd want to say is just for everyone to recognize, this isn't something where Rational Faiths is going to be taking any kind of money from this as well. This is all going to this particular cause, which is helping with malnutrition in children in these developing countries. And I think it's fascinating. I was talking to my brother about this, and he was really interested in it as well. But I think that sometimes these different kind of topics are a little complicated. I mean, talking about poverty and talking about taking care of the poor and needy is kind of a controversial thing, because then you have things like panhandlers, and you have some of these different groups that take advantage of people. And so I think a lot of us have that fear of being taken advantage of. We all want to help. We all want to make a difference, but we're a little afraid of doing some of these things. And personally, like, Bob Reese is one of my favorite individuals in the area of Mormon studies. I think that he is just such a great guy. And that's something that I was kind of talking with my brother about, is that, I mean, I personally have a lot of faith in this cause, particularly because Bob Reese is involved, and I think he's just so honest. So I think that's an important thing to remember, that this is a really good organization. I think that the money will be going to what it needs to be going, and not some of these other things that we would, some of us would worry about.
Yeah, that's right. We're just trying to facilitate this organization to do the work that they've set out to do in their mission. So that's all that we're trying to do, and join with us.